Well, we're in chapter 23, and I wanted to add these verses to verse 6, where he perceived that the one part was Sadducees and the other part was Pharisees. And then he cries out, makes a statement about the resurrection. And then things really got interesting. He was given this by the Spirit, and otherwise, I don't think Paul's situation was going to be turning for the better. It may have immediately got a lot worse, and we don't know God's full view of this situation, and we don't know what would have happened if Paul had not made this statement. But I think God knew that something had to be said and something had to be done that would give Paul proper time to have a proper hearing, and then God could use that to finally get him to Rome. And so this perception is there. I think it came from God. It may not have. Can't prove it really one way or the other. But he did promise in Matthew 10 and verses 17 and following, as well as Luke chapter 12, verses 11 and following, as well as chapter 21 of Luke, verses 10 to 15, he said, "Do not give any thought for what you will say in that hour when you're brought before the magistrates, but I will give you what to speak." And there's times where you would plan things as the Spirit of God would bring things to you and you'd write those things down. He is not saying never write anything down. Just go into every situation cold, trusting God. That is not what he's saying. He is saying that as you're praying and you're going to face these magistrates, if nothing's in your mind and you don't have anything to write down, don't worry. Just trust me. I'll give it to you when you need it. Sometimes he gives it before, sometimes he gives it right in the hour. The whole point is just trust God. He'll give you what needs to be said. And whether it needs to be written down or not, that's what God knows, and he knows when to exactly give it. He knows how to put us more and more in these situations where we're forced to trust God. And he's more or less saying, I'm not going to give it to you until you're right there and you need it. And out of it, good's going to come, because you're going to find that I'm faithful, that I'm true to my word. And so here's Paul, and he's standing before this throng of people, and they're not there with smiley faces and all happy to see him and just wanting to get his autograph and give him a big hug and a pat on the back and stick a $5 bill in his hand and tell him how much they've appreciated his ministry. That is not what they are feeling. And we're dealing with demonic spirits, demonized people, and God intervenes through this point of information about the resurrection. It's, to my mind, about all I can say regarding it is, this is very interesting. You know, it's not the kind of thing that he gives all sorts of data so that we can really see, now, why did this happen? Why did he feel to say this? I mean, what is really the purpose of this? It gets the Pharisees and the Sadducees upset. It gets the Pharisees, in an overall sense, on Paul's side, but he's still going to have to stand there before the Roman governor, and it's still going to take a number of years before he gets to Rome. What would have transpired if he hadn't have said this? We're not really given that information. We don't really know. So overall, it's just kind of an interesting thing, and we're not able to really say that much about it. We're not able to come to that many conclusions other than just saying, well, it appears that God gave him this, and God knew that this would be a way to protect him, that this would keep him alive, this would finally get him to Rome. That's really about all that we can say about it. That's all that I can really say about it. Now, the Sadducees, there in verse 8, they say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit. But the Pharisees confess both. Now, this phrase, angel nor spirit, this probably involves angels and demons as well as spiritual experiences. And then when it says that the Pharisees confess both, It doesn't mean the Pharisees confess both angels and spirits. It means that they confess the resurrection plus angels and spirits. Those are the two things. Resurrection, and then the second, angels and spirits. And that's still a very obscure statement. Neither angel nor spirit. Now verse 9 says, and there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove. Means they a big argument, and they came right to the forefront saying, well, that's what we believe. Saying, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. And then it says, this last phrase, let us not fight against God, is not in the Greek. It just says, but if an angel or spirit has spoken to him, we find no fault in that. See, we believe in the resurrection. We believe in angels. We believe in spirits. And so we find no fault in him if this is what has happened. But then that last phrase, let us not fight against God, that's not in the Greek. Now this is kind of a perplexing thing, but what we have to realize is this. Paul is literally a stranger in Jerusalem. And it isn't that everybody knows who Paul is. The ones hearing him really know nothing about him. These Sadducees and these Pharisees that are listening to him, they don't know him. He has been away from Jerusalem for the most of the past 20 years. 20 years have passed. He's off ministering to the Gentiles. He's not down here in Jerusalem. He's not in this area of the world. He's not. He's elsewhere. They don't know who he is. His picture's not on the front of the Palestinian Gazette. I mean, they don't know who he is. There's not all sorts of programs on TV warning the people about the Apostle Paul. And the radio disc jockeys are also warning him. And there's all sorts of talk shows. And he's being interviewed. And they don't know who he is. They don't know who Paul is. They don't know what he looks like. For the most part, they know nothing about this man. And so he's brought before them. And he stands there, and he just starts to say, now all that I've done with good conscience, and smacks right in the face. So he just opens his mouth, and wham, they let him have it. And he calls the high priest a whited wall, and then the guy next to him says, don't you know that you're reviling God's high priest? And everybody else there probably, in all honesty, is thinking, boy, our high priest is a creep. And the high priest is not a man that everybody loves. He's a greedy man. He's misused his office. They all know it. For the most part, they probably all hate him. And so this, maybe even more than angering them against Paul in a certain sense, angers them against the high priest. And they don't know who this guy is, really. They don't know what all the uproar is. And the rumors, they're just abounding by the hundreds and thousands. And they've probably got enough perception to realize that rumors don't amount to anything. And so then Paul, after that, settles down, and he apologizes and says, you're not supposed to speak evil of the ruler of the people. Then he says the thing about the resurrection. And he's got these two groups, Sadducees and Pharisees. The Pharisees, this is about all they know, is what he's now saying regarding the resurrection. They say, we find no fault with that. This is quite an amazing situation. And so the Pharisees, they rise up in great strength, and the argument just becomes all the more heated. Now verse 11, I want to make one other point here about verse 9. Notice how they say, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. Well, that's kind of confusing. If spirit is demon, then they would be saying, we find no problem if a demon has spoken to him. So the word spirit it cannot mean demon in and of itself. It just can't. I mean, they're not that confused. They're not that much against God that they're now accepting things from demons. Now, they are, but they don't know it. But as far as what they're thinking consciously and what they're saying theologically, they're not saying, well, if he had a demon speak this or an angel speak it, we see no problem. They would see a big problem. What they must mean by spirit is they must mean spiritual experiences. It must mean more like what Moses experienced, more like what Isaiah experienced, where there were real spiritual experiences, experiences of the Spirit, in the Spirit. Then there are cases regarding angels. There's cases where it just seems to be God, and it's a spiritual experience. Then there's other cases where it's angels. And so they accepted angels, and they accepted spiritual experiences. I think that's what it's speaking of. I think that's what it represents. Because it cannot be speaking of just take the word spirit and now say it equals demons. Because they would find a great problem with that. Now, I think the overall statement, though, as far as angels and spirits, I think in the overall sense, it does involve demons as well. They accepted the spirit realm. The Sadducees didn't. The Sadducees were just of this. They were very materialistically minded. And God to them, really in the overall sense, had become very impersonal and in actuality non-existent, no experiences, much like the religious leaders today. I don't even know how they can preach their sermons or be a pastor of a church. They don't even believe in God. They're not even experiencing God. There are thousands of them not even born again. I don't have this. I just can't even. It's mind-boggling. It's overwhelming. It makes no sense whatsoever, but just like a vocation. It's their job, and this is the way they're going to serve society, and what a deception. So this is more or less where the Sadducees are. But at least the Pharisees are still believing in spiritual experiences and angels, although they're not having any contact with them, and they're not having any spiritual experiences. But it was Nicodemus, who's a Pharisee, he came to Christ, and he understood that God was with this man by the very things that he did. It shows that there was an openness to spiritual things. But it wasn't that he had a whole lot of understanding, because he thinks Jesus is saying, go back in your mother's womb, and that was a little bit perplexing for Nicodemus. That would be very perplexing for us if that's what he actually meant. But of course he didn't. He's speaking in a spiritual vein, so he's open to that, but yet because of their foundation and lack of experience, they didn't even really understand spiritual things. But they're, it's shown here that they're accepting Paul's basic statement. And so I feel like God's Spirit intervened to give Paul necessary protection. It's like he's providing some protection for Paul and really making a way so that one day he will get to Rome and that the ministry will be further enhanced in that fashion. Although, as I've mentioned, I don't think this is really the way that he wanted Paul to get to Rome. I think there was a better way to go there. He was a free man previously, and he could have just traveled there. This is going to use up a number of years before he gets there. Overall, I believe it's wasted time. Now, God still uses it, and there grows the relationship, I'm sure, between Paul and the Lord during this time. But a lot of other souls that could have been strengthened and ministered to, they're not being ministered to. And I'll tell you this, there's not really any souls being saved here in Jerusalem because of Paul. This is not producing another day of Pentecost. This is not winning another 3,000 and then maybe another 5,000 or whatever exactly took place at the Gate Beautiful. That's not what's happening here. And so really, in a certain sense, it's much more wasted time. He could have just gone to Rome. God really wanted him to go to Rome, which he did. He could have just gone there. He didn't have to go down to Jerusalem. And God's warning him, don't go there. You're going to get bound up. And this is not going to be good. And there's, the Spirit was witnessing to him, city after city. They were warning him. God was warning him. But his heart was for his people. And so that's what caused him to go there. Remember, that's why he argues to begin with when God first tells him, don't stay here. Here comes this vision. He's in this trance. God tells him, now leave. And he says, no, I'm not going to leave. These people will listen to me. They know who I am. I did all this persecuting. And God had to, I'm sure, speak very, very pointedly and very powerfully to get him to leave Jerusalem. Otherwise, he would have been killed right at that time. They would have killed him. That's exactly what they would have done to him. They would have done to him what they had done to Stephen. They would have done the same thing. God knew it. And God said, I'm not going to have this happen to you. You get out of Jerusalem. And he argued. But see, that shows what his heart was for the people. I think that's what ends up being the problem here. It's like Jonah. Jonah won't go to Nineveh because of his love for his people. And Paul goes to Jerusalem because of his love for his people. I think this is what's happening. Now, here he is put in prison, And this is in verse 10, and there arose a great dissension, and the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them. This was not a real friendly little debate, just a little lighthearted discussion. Just a few of the guys together talking about politics. This was demons by the hundreds that were manifesting. So I commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and to bring him up to the castle, that is, to the barracks. And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." Now this is really a wonderful thing. This has been 2 days of great strain, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. What happens to us, and it really does happen to us, we read these stories and it is very hard to make them applicable. It's hard to really bring them into real life. And so Paul is just this pillar of strength, and he stands in these situations and everything just bounces off him like Superman, and bullets are bouncing off. Goes over the prison and it's just glory be to God, and there's no problem and no strain, no pressure, no demon can bother me. That's not the way that it is. It's not the way that it is. That's not life. That's not reality. Paul was drained. Paul was pressured to the hilt by demons. All the demons and those people, what were they doing to Paul? They were putting pressure on him. This was something that he was worn out. This is the strategy of the devil, to wear us out, to break down our defenses so that we get weak. This is what happens. Don't get enough sleep, don't eat right, not praying, not really making the full dedications, not really being as attentive in service or whatever. The devil's working to put pressure, strain, break down certain defenses, gain inroads. So the devil does all the time. And that's his strategy, that's his plan, and he doesn't let up. He puts as much pressure as he's allowed to do so by God, and then if we open other doors, he takes that and rightfully is allowed to put even more pressure. And this happens day by day and week by week with saint after saint after saint. And even the strongest are severely attacked and find themselves very wearied from time to time. And so Paul is wearied. And this experience really gave him strength. I am positive that this was very important. This word from God would help him to go through what he was about to go through. It wasn't going to get better. This process of their court system there, of being able to see the Roman governor and all of that, just like present-day America's court system. You got some real important thing, and you need an answer 6 weeks ago, well, you're not on the docket for another 6 months. This is what happens all the time. Our court system is a joke. Their court system was just as bad. And what's happening in this, as we'll see, is that Felix, I believe it is, who's the Roman governor at this time, he's just trying to do anything to gain further favor of the Jews. So when he finds out that this man in his custody is something that makes the Jews happy, he'll milk that thing for all it's worth to gain their favoritism. That's what he wants. It's a very common thing in all societies. Terrible situation. This thing about justice being blind and not caring and just wanting to know the truth and just wanting to know if they got the right man, forget it.
Right.
Forget it.
Right.
The lawyers, who some are very honest and men of integrity, but others, well, I don't know what they are. They're in that business to defend their client with every lie they can muster. That is terrible. That is not a justice system. That's an absolute farce. That's a absurdity. Terrible situation. I hope I'm never in court. We probably will end up in court just by living for God. But boy, I want to stay as far away from court as I possibly can. It's not the way to get things resolved. It's not the way to get answers. It's not the way to find justice. Unfortunately, it's not the way to find justice. I wish that it was. Now, we show respect to those people. And we honor the position they're in. And we'll do that. And we do that with the government officials and state officials. We do that, and that's what we should do. And we abide by the laws, and that's the proper thing commanded in the scriptures. But wow, it's going to be a lot different in the millennium. You're going to have a justice system in the millennium that works, that's fair. It's one of honesty and integrity. The judge will be here, and he'll know how to take care of these things. The millennium is going to be a tremendous time for planet Earth. So God gives him strength. And we find the next thing is that there are 40 men who bind themselves to an oath. This is in verse 12. They put themselves under a very solemn oath. So serious was the oath that death was the penalty of not fulfilling it. We won't eat or drink until we have killed Paul. Verse 13, and they were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. Literally, which had made this swearing together. They vowed together. They swore together. We are going to kill him. We will fast until he's dead. And they came to the chief priests and the elders. And see, this is how honest and fair and desirous of truth the chief priests and the elders are. These crooks, these vigilantes, these people who they have put themselves under this curse to kill somebody, they can come secret to everybody else, but openly to these people and say, this is what we want to do, help us. And they'll strike a deal and say, we'll be glad to help you. Real fair, real honest, a lot of integrity. Verse 15, I'll just read it in the New American Standard. It says, now therefore you and the council, that is the Sanhedrin, notify the commander to bring him down to you, that is Paul, as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. So there, this is the deal that they're striking. Now you go tell the commander that you need to evaluate Paul's case more carefully. And then when they're bringing him down, then we'll kill him. That's what we'll do. And they all got big smiles. And all saying, oh boy, that sounds good. And real desirous for truth, living by the law. They only want right. And they want anything but right. They're not going to live by the law either. Only as it will serve them. Only as it will help them. Now, an interesting thing happens. We don't have the slightest idea how it happens. And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. Now, out of nowhere comes Paul's nephew. Where does he come from? How does he overhear the plot? We don't have the slightest idea. This is a peculiar verse. We don't hear anything more about him. He tells him to go tell the chief captain, which he does. He's able to go in and visit Paul and say, Paul, I overheard this. Doesn't tell us how. Doesn't give us any detail. Paul tells him to go tell the chief captain, and that's it. It's quite an amazing thing. And so this just shows how God can protect his people. He can use things that we would have never even imagined. We didn't even know Paul had a nephew. Maybe Paul didn't even know he had a nephew. We're not given any information, but God makes a way. See, for God to make a way to protect his people, it's so simple. It is simple for God. All he needs is people to keep believing him. If God says, now, you're going to get to Rome, all Paul did is say, okay, I'm going to get to Rome. I'll just keep believing you. Now, it doesn't mean it was going to be easy to keep believing him, and there'd be pressure not to, and there'd be reason not to. But as long as he would keep believing, and God will give him the strength to keep believing, there always will be the way to Rome. And God knows how to watch over the whole situation. He knows how to get Paul's nephew right here to hear this, and then he knows what to do, comes to Paul. Paul knows what to do. He goes to the chief captain knows what to do. I don't know how God does these things. And God doesn't want us to know all the details, because I think that's more the point. He's just more or less saying, let me just show you, once again, I know how to take care of my own. I'm not going to tell you how I did it. I'm not going to tell you how I set this up, but I did it. You know God did this. Somehow God did this. But he doesn't tell us how he did it. We don't need to know how he did it. We just need to see that he did it. and then just say, well, Lord, I don't need to know how either. That would be a good revelation for us to keep getting, and we are, day by day, more and more to understand, we don't need to know how. I don't need to know how this works. I don't need to know how this is going to come to pass. I don't need to know how. All I have to do is what you've told me to do. That's to trust you. That's the bottom line of our whole life right there. Too much concern about how, why, want all sorts of explanation. This is very common to man. Why? Because we have a conscience. We ended up being partakers of Adam's trade, the tree of life or tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I'm glad we have a conscience. That's helped us to at least know that there's right and wrong, and God has used it to his advantage. But, oh, much better to be at the tree of life. Much better to just say, I'm going to live by every word of God. Everything that proceeds out of his mouth, that's how I'm going to live. And then we aren't living our lives by whys and wherefores and how it comes. And unless you give me the answer and the full explanation, and when I can see it all, then I'll do it. That's the way Thomas was. Thomas said, when I see him, I'll believe. And Jesus rebuked him. And Jesus did show up, and he was able to see, but he didn't get much of a reward for that kind of believing. That kind of believing doesn't lay much treasure up on the other side. He said, blessed will be those who believe and who have not seen. That's putting treasures on the other side. Now, God will do a lot of things where it's not really the way he wants to do it, and he'll show us some things and give us some answers and kind of, in a sense, succumb to our will, just like he gave him King Saul when he never wanted to give him a king. God will do things like that because he loves us. But, oh, there's a higher way to do things. There's a better way. We haven't always had God where we've allowed him to do it the best way in our lives.
That's right.
I think there's a lot of times where just out of his great love for us, he's had to more or less condescend down here and do it at this level, and it wasn't the best way. It wasn't the way he really wanted to do it. That's because he loves us, though. He'll do that because he loves us. That's a pretty incredible thing. But then he's requiring that we learn how to walk better and better up at this level. And we're getting up there. We're not real good on that high wire yet, but after a while, we'll learn how to walk up there in the realm of the Spirit with his power, and we won't even need the net below. We'll know how to walk up there. Right now, no thanks. Planet Earth, where we know, understand, have it all figured out. Okay, that's the way I'm going to live my Christian life. And, but God's getting us up. He knows how to move us up higher. It's a step-by-step process. So here, God does this really incredible thing, and it's the way that God is able to preserve his life at this point in time. So they take Paul, and so you have in verse 20, the Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow. This is where it's all being explained. But do not yield unto them, because they lie in wait. This whole thing's being explained. So the chief captain then let the young man depart. This is where it's being explained to him. And he says, now don't tell anybody about this. And so this is where it's all being made clear to this chief captain, and then he's going to take the right steps with this thing. And then he called two centurions, make ready 200 soldiers, and then 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen at the third hour of the night. That's at 9 p.m. This is a very heavy guard, and this soldier understands, this chief captain understands, I'm accountable to Rome. This is why he does this. He's accountable to Rome. He does not care about Paul. I do not believe he cares about Paul at all. He could care less about this man. His only concern is from the fact he's a Roman citizen, and if anything happens to him, it's his neck. Paul gets killed, this Roman soldier is going to have to answer to Rome. This man's a Roman citizen. Paul's a Roman citizen. He has rights. If this soldier allows the Jews to take away those rights, this soldier is in trouble with Caesar. That's the way the kingdom was set up. So this is why it protects Paul like this. Well, I just have such a fond place in my heart for Paul, and we've just grown so close. I have such a love for him, and there's such a bond. He doesn't feel that way. He would just as soon let these people tear this man to shreds and just get the whole thing out of his hair. Really, that's the truth. This is where God works in ways that you'd say, there's no way he can do this. There's no way that God can protect Paul in this situation. Nobody's there who wants to help Paul. But yet they get trapped by their own laws. They get trapped by other factors that apparently have nothing to do with anything until you see God use them to his advantage. God knows how to take all sorts of things where people are going to be trapped by their own laws. They're going to be trapped by their own reasoning. And they're going to end up doing things for us where they don't want to do a thing for us. They would just as soon run us over with a big steamroller. They don't like us. They're not candidates for salvation. They're not listening to the gospel. They could care less about the gospel, but yet they're going to have to help us. And they're not going to want to help us, but they're going to have to. There's going to be situations just like that. God knows how to use these people against their own desires. And then there's also the people that start to want to help us because they kind of like us. And that's even more amazing. It's like the captain of the guard of the Babylonians, Nebuzaradan. You all know about Nebuzaradan, don't you? Wonderful name. Name your children Nebuzaradan. And maybe change your own name. And that is your last name or something. It'd be real delightful, I'm sure. But he's the captain of the guard of the Babylonians. And he really befriends Jeremiah. And takes care of Jeremiah, gives him money, gives him food. It's an amazing thing. Now, what is this guy doing? And it's not because he's compelled to do it. Nobody's telling him to do it. But he just does it. He kind of puts Jeremiah under his wing and takes care of him. I don't know if he felt sorry for him or what, but for various reasons, he takes care of him. And it's quite an amazing thing. So you get all these different kinds of situations that God is going to work in. So we can really trust God. We can really have confidence in God. We're going to face a lot of difficult situations. When I think about what they're trying to run through, like there through the King County Council, about the homosexual laws, that fair employment ordinance, and all these other things, it just looks like, boy, we're going to get run right over. We're going to lose all of our rights and privileges. And that's what it begins to look like. But somehow God, when people will pray and believe him and do what they can do according to his word and according to proper principles, it's amazing what God can do. With people that will obey, people who will submit, people who will exercise faith. And really, that's all he needs. And he can keep doors open that should never stay open. And he'll shut doors that should never be shut. No way that this should be shut, and God comes right along and just shuts it. And this is where something should have flooded in and destroyed us, hindered us, overcome us. God just pushes it shut just like that. Here's all these demonic forces. It looks like they should shut this door and we wouldn't have this pathway of ministry. And God just opens the door, puts his hand there, and those demons can push all they want and they can't do a thing. He just holds it there with his little finger. Absolutely no problem to God whatsoever, as long as people keep believing him. Just keep opening up to God. That's why these accounts are so important to us, to keep building faith, to cause us to be confident in God, that he's for us. He'll see us through. He hasn't promised to watch over us, and then he runs away from us because it gets too difficult, and then he just doesn't have the power to take care of it, and he ends up afraid of the demons. God's not afraid of the demons. He's not afraid of the devil. All the things that the liberals are doing and all the lawlessness and all that, it doesn't amount to anything as far as a problem to God. He can raise a standard and hold it all back and doesn't amount to anything. And we need to put all of our confidence in him. And day by day and through all the situations of life, that's what we're learning to do.
That's right.
And it's a tremendous thing.
Amen.
So now verses 25 to 30 record the captain of the guard's letter. And his name is Claudius Lysias. That's the name of the captain of the guard. And he writes a letter to most excellent Governor Felix. And so he writes this letter talking about Paul and how Paul was going to be killed, but he rescued him, and I brought him forth into the council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions. No one has told me how the Jews were going to kill him, and I made this, set this guard up, and have now transported him. And so what they're going to do is they're going to take him from Jerusalem to the city of Caesarea. And verse 31 talks about the city of Antipatris, and this is a city about halfway between Caesarea and Jerusalem. So here, we're going through this account of all that is transpiring here. They write a letter, and then it just says there in verse 31, then the soldiers, as was commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, and just the city halfway between Caesarea and Jerusalem. And then on the morrow, they left the horsemen to go with him and return to the barracks. Now, what this means, although it's a little bit hard to follow in the King James, is that only the 70 horsemen continued with Paul. So then the 200 soldiers and the 200 spearmen, I think it was, returned back. And since they've gone halfway, they felt like there's really no more threat. Now, we don't really know whatever happened to these people under their vow. I kind of think they didn't keep their vow. I'm sure that their growling stomachs won this particular match, and their vow amounted to nothing. And so then, finally, we see in verse 34, and when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, said, I will hear thee, said he, when thine accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Herod's judgment hall was a place built by Herod the Great, and it's where now Felix was living. And I'm sure it was more like, kind of like a castle, and it was probably a very nice residence. And evidently Paul was placed in a very comfortable dwelling, and so he's just here now in Caesarea. So we've gotten from Jerusalem to Caesarea. We're partway on the way to Rome, but still got a long ways to go. Then chapter 24, and after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. Now, overall, Paul is going to be detained here for 2 years. Total waste of time. That's in verse 27. But after 2 years, Festus came into Felix's room. This means that Festus replaced Felix. Felix was governor from 52 to 58 A.D. So Felix was governor from 52 to 58, and then he's replaced by Festus. Felix was very corrupt, very wicked, very, very wicked, hated by the Jews, like all Roman governors. And so this next thing is very humorous, is what it is. And if Felix didn't have so many demons of pride, he would have just started laughing at this orator. And anybody who was anybody who knew the situation, this would be enough for a comedy special. And this is just a joke. This is what happens, and the reason it happens is because the pride is so great, people will accept lavish praise when everybody knows that it's lies, but they'll still accept it. That's how great the demons of pride are on this man Felix. And this orator, he's hired to come down here. Some lawyers, this is what he is. Unfortunately, some lawyers, they're just hired liars. That's unfortunately the case. Not with all. I'm not putting Chuck Morin in that category, or the other ones in our assembly. Although, it's just a profession that has been abused. Right. And I think that in these kind of professions, as we're supporting our brethren, we need to really pray for our brethren in their different jobs and different positions, because there are real spirits that cause all these kind of compromises that people make, and they're not easy situations. I think it would be very hard. I think it's a commendable thing that we have lawyers that are living for God, because I think overall that would be a very, very difficult thing to do, is to be a lawyer really living for God and to do things the right way.
Right.
I mean, it's not an easy situation, because there aren't many lawyers that are doing things the right way. They just end up being hired, and they'll just use their abilities for whatever the money is telling them to do. That's unfortunate. I'm glad we have the lawyers that we do in our assembly. I think that's a real plus, and it will probably be a very big help in the future, as we may have great need for people to be able to help us in various court situations, because I'm sure we will be facing a number of court situations over the next number of years. Yeah. And so this is a real plus and a real help. But in the meantime, they need our prayers. They need our support. And so I'm not saying anything that I hope that none of you will take this and end up with the wrong view. A lawyer in a basic thing, in the position they occupy, that's a very commendable position. And it's a position where they're just wanting to help people, and they're just supposed to be basically interpreters of the law. But our society and all sorts of situations have really changed that, and so unfortunately they haven't ended up being that in many, many cases. But I'm not saying anything, and I hope you don't take this as derogatory against the profession itself or against the individual himself. There's a lot of very good lawyers, a lot of them who maybe in some instances aren't even saved, that are still very conscientious and very dedicated to their profession. And you do find some out there like that in various professions where everybody else is corrupt, but here's this guy, he's not really corrupt and he's not even saved. Then you find some who are Christians that are more corrupt than some of the others, and this guy is actually born again. So that just shows where the enemy can take advantage of people. But anyway, this man's hired, and he's a lawyer, and it's like he's a prosecuting attorney, and he was probably hired because of his eloquence and also because of his knowledge of the Roman law. It's probably why he was hired. And he began to accuse Paul there in verse 2, seeing that by thee we enjoy very great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence. Totally false. They may enjoy quietness, but they hate every moment of it because they're in subjection to Rome. And the nation is not enjoying all sorts of worthy deeds. Felix and the other Roman officials in the land of Judea, they're just simply crooks. They're taxing the people. And so whatever things are done to kind of appease the Jewish people as far as certain building projects or whatever, it's all coming out of their pocket, and they don't really like it. They're not enjoying it. These are lavish lies. We accepted always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Just a liar. That's what he is. Professional liar. It's like professional criers. And they would hire these mourners at deaths, and they could cry buckets of tears. Or they just put money in this man's hand, and he could lie. Put money in some people's hands, and they can cry. And this guy got criers and got liars. Both put the right money in their hands, and they can do it. No problem. Notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency. A few words. Clemency is kindness. Now, to say that he's kind is not true. He once assassinated a high priest. This guy is a murderer, a thief. He's greedy. He's a liar. He's got the same spirits that this orator has. That's maybe why they were getting along. That's maybe why he was soaking all of this up. It's just a total joke. And so there, he's talking about how kind Felix is. He's not kind at all. They all know that he isn't kind. They all should say, forget this nonsense. But see, they're not really out for truth. It's just a game. Ever notice all the games?
Yeah.
With you get these officials from foreign countries, and they have the band playing the 21-gun salute, and they all act like they're friends, and they hate one another's guts. So ridiculous. How idiotic. They should, as they sit down to meal, the guy should take his cup of wine, just throw it in his face, kick him in the knee and say, I hate you and we're going to bomb your nation tomorrow morning. And all this diplomacy. If somebody speaks honestly, they They get upset at him in the paper.
Right.
You know, if this official says the truth about this country, or if President Reagan says the truth about the Russians, they go, ah, no, don't. It'll spoil our diplomatic relations. Diplomacy is just two guys who get together and they lie to one another. It's basically what it is. Oh, yeah. Big, lavish meals and all. I mean, that's what happens.
That's right.
The diplomacy is nonsensical. And then they all sit down with a big formal signing of a treaty that's going to be broken tomorrow afternoon. Now, I mean, don't they see what's going on? I think it shows the deception of the demonic spirits, the power the devil holds on their mind. They don't even know what's going on. Now it says, we have found this man a pestilent fellow and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, a pestilent fellow, that means a pest and a plague. It's like the bug that brings the plague. He's a pest and a plague. And he's an instigator of insurrection. And the word world here refers to the Roman Empire. When he says he's the ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, he's using the word Nazarene in connection with Jesus, who's from Nazareth. And so, the followers of Christ oftentimes were referred to in a very derogatory sense as Nazarenes. Because what good can come from Nazareth? It's a very negative term. And they're using it in a contemptuous way to describe a group of heretics. So that's how it's being used here. Who also hath gone about to profane the temple. That means he actually went about to desecrate and destroy the temple. Yes, they found him in the temple with 2.5 tons of TNT. And he had the wires all set up and he just struck the match and he was about to light it. And he was there to destroy the temple. It's just a big lie. Whom we took and would have judged according to our law. We would have taken care of the whole thing. You wouldn't have had to worry about this. But then this Captain Lysias, he came upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands. So now Lysias, he's the bad guy. Commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. So you'll find out the same thing. Oh, wonderful Felix, whom we love and adore, you're so kind and sweet and considerate. And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so, and they're all giving their amens. Yes, that's right. Yes. And so this is what is transpiring here. Very interesting. And then verses 10 to 21 give us Paul's defense. The liars get done talking, and then Paul speaks the truth. And that's what happens. We've got the liar speaking, and now we have one man who's going to speak the truth. It's not real good odds here. It's one against all these liars. And it's not a healthy situation. This is not where you want to be spending your afternoons. Not real pleasant company. Doesn't feel real accepted. He's got a lot of pressure on him. You know there's demon spirits attacking him. They're all against him. They all hate him. Every single person there hates him. Felix hates him, probably just because this is a nuisance. He doesn't like being bothered by the Jews. You know how much the Roman governors hated being there in Judah? This is Siberia, as far as they're concerned. They're down in Siberia. That's how they viewed it. They hated being here. The Jews are the most obnoxious people on planet Earth, as far as they're concerned. And they're always talking about their religion and their laws, and there's always some idiotic dispute, something to do with their temple and priesthood and scriptures and all sorts of other nonsensical things. They won't go along with us. They won't let us bring our silver eagle in and do other things we normally do in all other countries. And we threaten to kill them, and they say, go ahead and kill us. Oh, no, and if Caesar found out we killed them all, then what did he do to us? All sorts of things happen. They hate being there. So Felix, he hates this, but yet he wants to somehow get their favor, and that's why he'll keep Paul here for 2 years. It's incomprehensible. It's totally illogical, makes no sense. None of it meshes. It shows demons. It's a whole state of confusion. The devil really knows how to orchestrate things like this. And Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, answered, forasmuch as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. I'm going to answer, I'll tell you, you're the judge. Now he's just giving him, all he's doing is giving him proper respect. Paul is not now going to pat Felix on the back and lavish him with all sorts of lies. He's giving him basic respect. He's saying, you're the judge. So I'm acknowledging that you're the judge. That's just proper submission to the authority. Felix is the authority. Now, if I stood before a very unjust judge, I'd stick my tongue out at him, right? No. You still show him respect. You don't say, now, sir, you're a creep. You're listening to all his lies. I'm going to tell you the truth, but because you're a creep, you won't listen to me. You don't say that. You just say, you're the judge. Now, here's my story. And you don't have a chip on your shoulder. And you don't have a negative frame of mind. Well, what's the use? What good will this do? Faith in God, giving proper respect to the authority, to the office. Even though the guy in the office doesn't belong in the office, he's in the office. There aren't very many Christians that understand that. Very few that really understand authority. Authority is only when you agree. If they're right in your estimation, then you follow. See, that's not authority. That's not submission. That's not going to work. That's why there's church split after church split after church split. That's why there's divorce after divorce after divorce. That's why there is. Because people don't agree. You're not right, so I don't have to submit. That is not the premise of submission. Of course, you can't violate your conscience, and you can't knowingly violate the Word of God. But the Word of God says to submit. Jeremiah submitted to the authorities, and they were all corrupt. He submitted to them, and he got off the hook. God knows how to use what he has told us to do. It's amazing how it works. It's really an amazing thing. It doesn't look like it would work. It looks like, well, no, we've got to take this into our own hands. This won't work. But Paul says, no, it's going to work. He said, I'm going to get to Rome, and I don't get to Rome by fighting the authorities. I get there by submitting. I get there by following God's word. It's amazing it works. It really is an amazing thing. It goes totally opposite of what the mind is saying. The mind in evaluating the circumstances, this is not going to work. This can't work. And yet it works. The marriage doesn't look like it's going to work. Now, if I submit to my husband, it's just going to get worse. I mean, I got to fight him on every point. Well, as long as the person fights, it gets worse.
Right.
It's amazing when they submit and honor the position. Honor that delegated authority of the position. It's amazing how they can change things. It doesn't always fully change it. It doesn't always bring this one into salvation. But it starts to make it livable. And it starts to give God opportunity to work. It's a wonderful thing. God really knows what he's doing in all this. So he gives proper respect. And he says, because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went to Jerusalem for to worship. So I'm just telling you what I did there. So I went up to the temple. They neither found me in the temple disputing, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues, nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. So he just makes a very simple defense. It says in verse 18, whereunto certain Jews of Asia, that is, Jews of Asia Minor, those same Jews that were upset at him, are now down here for the feast, and they see him in the temple, and they found me purifying the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult. I wasn't there causing any sort of a uproar. I wasn't gathering a crowd. I wasn't trying to cause a riot. I wasn't doing anything. Who ought to have been here before thee and object if they had aught against me. Now this is a very significant point. It says, now there's this group that accused me. Where are they? Where are my accusers? They're from Asia Minor. Where are they? I'm here in Caesarea. I'm before you. You're the judge. Where are my accusers? These people, they're not the accusers. My accusers were these ones from Asia Minor. Where are they? It's a pretty significant point. They're not there. They're back home. Or else let these same here say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council. Except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. And so he shows that the problem is simply the issue of the resurrection. This goes back to chapter 23 and verse 6. And so we'll say just a couple more things about chapter 24 and go on to chapter 25 next time. This is a very difficult situation for Paul, but God is giving him strength. God's giving him wisdom. He knows how to just keep trusting God in the matter. He knows how to say the right things, the proper things, the wise things, and God's going to use it to his advantage. So Paul is going to end up in Rome. But he's still got a shipwreck and a few other things that'll be part of the process.
Yep, it worked. Depends on breaking the cellar that I've been listening to and talking with. He's very, very close on him, very much into the occult. And our background is similar. That's what it touched him. But nonetheless, it's very anti-Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting there at my lunch hour, and he walked in and he said, I've got a strange request. For you. He had written a thing, and so I thought he was going to, he had more seniority than lead therapist. I thought he was going to say, well, you know, I heard this, and you know, I just read it. I didn't say that at all. Bill Thompson down the hall, and this guy's been in for months, he's real depressed. And somebody's going and talking to him, will you go ahead and talk to him? The man gave his heart to the Lord that night.
I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, it came through. I mean, the last person that, you know, I would expect, you know, Bill just looked at me and said, you're pretty good with stuff like this.